That we're going to look at today is the story of Jesus walking on the water. I think I'm getting an echo. So the story of Jesus walking on water has been my favorite Jesus story ever since I can remember, from the time I was a little kid. And I think that it probably has shaped the trajectory that my life has taken. So I don't know if you guys know this, but one of my first jobs, actually, since I was 16 years old, my job at Solid Rock Bible Camp has been water ski instructor and speedboat driver. Okay, so I love water. Whenever I go somewhere new, if there's water there, I will get in it. I have been in the North Sea. I have been in the Irish Sea. I have been in the Gulf of Mexico. I have been in the Gulf of Alaska. I have been in the same day, I have been in the Atlantic Ocean on one side of Florida and on the other side of Florida. So this is just something that I do because I just really like water. So I teach in Alaska. I teach people how to water ski. And I tell people that I'm the best water ski instructor in the state of Alaska. What I don't say is I'm probably the only water ski instructor in the state of Alaska. But I have been doing this for a really, really, really long time. And this summer, we always have new staff every summer. And this summer, I haven't been driving the speedboat for a couple years just because, like, when the work crew boys come to me at 8:30 and they say, "Hey, let's go water skiing." And my first thought is, shouldn't you guys be in bed? It's time for somebody new to step into that program area. So I haven't been driving speedboat as much. But there was this one time when they didn't have a speedboat driver and somebody needed to drive the boat to drive the Wasp, which is an inflatable toy that we pull. And so I said, okay, fine. As long as it's not raining, I'll drive the Wasp. And one of our new staff members looked at me kind of puzzled and go, "Oh, can you drive the speedboat?" And I said to him, "I am the best inflatable puller in the state of Alaska." And he again looked at me kind of puzzled and he goes, "You just say that out loud to people?" I mean, so I took the work crew boys. I took them on the inflatable. And at the end, when they got off, they're like, "Oh, she's the best driver we've ever had." So I'm like, "See, I told you so." This has nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about, but I just wanted you to know where I'm coming from with this story. I just really like water. So Jesus walking on water just seems really interesting to me. And then Peter walking on water, also just very fascinating to me. When I was over in Israel, we spent several days on, like, in a hotel right on the Sea of Galilee. And then one of the days we actually went out in a boat. And I so badly wanted to get out of the boat. Not to see if I could walk on water, but just because I wanted to see how Peter felt when he put his legs over the side of the boat. What was he feeling for? Was he feeling for, like, firmness down there? Or did he expect to just sink and then pop back up? I don't know what Peter thought, but I wanted to experience what he felt. And alas, I could not do that because the boat that we were in, like, the sides of it were 6 feet high. And I could have gotten out, but I could have never got back in. So I did not get a chance to do what I wanted to do on the Sea of Galilee. And I also, by the way, looked for a speedboat there that could take me water skiing. And like I'm standing there on the beach waving money saying, "Somebody taking me water skiing." But we happened to be there. That day was a holiday. And so all the boats were in the marinas. They weren't out on the water. So I didn't get a water ski on the Sea of Galilee either. So I got to go back. Okay, so this is all an introduction to the story of Jesus walking on the water and what it means to me. Now, this story is found in three of our four Gospels, and the details are so alike that they were really easy to mesh together. Each one of the stories has a different emphasis, but you can mesh them together. And so the handout that you have, this is my attempt to take those three accounts in the three Gospels and mesh them together. So that's why there's no place that says where this is found. So this is in Matthew, in Mark, and in John. So I'm going to read this to you. "Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. Leaving them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. But now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. He was there alone on land, and he saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. The boat was already a considerable distance from land, about 3 or 4 miles, buffeted by the waves. Shortly before dawn, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water. He was about to pass them by. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were beside themselves with fear. "It's a ghost," they said. They all saw him and were terrified. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. I am. Do not be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," Jesus said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and, beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" Then they were willing to take him into the boat. And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Okay, so there's the story with all the details that the three gospel writers have given us. And we can come at this story with 5 different ways of interpreting it. So I'm going to talk about those 5 different ways. The first way is that this story is a myth. It is pure invention on the writer's part. And the purpose of that would be to make Jesus into something greater than he was. So the writers wanted to say, okay, Jesus is so great that this happens, but it's not true. Okay? So we have kind of dismissed that as a good way of interpreting this story. I'm still getting feedback here. I'm still getting an echo. The second way of looking at this story is as if it's an allegory. Okay, this would still be it didn't literally happen, but it was written as if it did happen for a greater purpose. So we're supposed to learn something from it, even though it didn't happen. The greater purpose would be we're taking a greater truth away from the story. The problem with this idea is that at this time, the Jews did not use allegory for teaching purposes. Allegory was at this time strictly a Greek teaching method, and the Jews had not yet adopted it. It would be several 100 years before the Jews adopted the method of allegorical teaching. So we pretty much discard this idea as well, although our culture has taken the allegorical ideas and kind of pasted them into the story, even though we believe that the story is true. We still take away the allegorical ideas. Okay, the third way is that there's a scientific explanation for this. Okay, now I try not to make fun of ideas of other people. I think that that's kind of tacky. I also try not to be sarcastic. But come on. So the main scientific explanation for this is that Jesus is floating on a sheet of ice. So apparently, once every 1,000 years, it's possible for ice to form above a spring that enters the Sea of Galilee. Although in Jesus' time, the chances might have been once every 60 years. So apparently, Jesus saw this ice sheet on the sea and thought to himself, "Oh, wouldn't this be fun to float out to the disciples and fool them into thinking I'm walking on the water?" Okay, so there is that explanation. Okay, so that's the scientific explanation. However, if we accept that Jesus was floating on a sheet of ice and not walking on the water, this turns him into a charlatan because he never said, you know, he fooled his disciples into thinking he was walking on the water for his own greater glory. Okay, so we're going to discard that idea as well. The fourth idea is that this is a miracle. So this is something supernatural that happened. And the reason it happened is because Jesus was teaching his disciples the need to have faith. Just a little bit more than Peter had, right? Okay, so this is the classic comfort story that we have taken to heart. This has been the classic comfort story since just a couple 100 years after this actually happened. It's just something that the church has latched onto. Jesus will calm our storms. Jesus is with us in the storms of life, and if we have enough faith, he can calm the storm for us. Okay, the problem with looking at this as just a miracle story is that that line between miracle and magic trick is really hazy. And it is all in the eye of the person who is looking at what happened. So we, as outsiders, can look into something that happened and we can say, oh, that's a miracle. So think if you're sitting in the audience of a magician, we say, oh, that's a miracle, when it's actually a magic trick. Okay, so there's that problem. Also, the line between miracle and luck is very hazy. Ted had a story that he liked to tell to illustrate this. He said there's a guy in a three-story building, and he falls out of a window, and just as he falls, a mattress truck drives by, and he lands on the mattress truck. Okay, is this a miracle? Some people would say yes. Or is it just this guy is really lucky? Some people would say yes. That line is really hazy between miracle and luck. Okay, and here's another thing about if this is a miracle. Jesus used miracles for specific reasons, and there's two main ones. One of them was for restoration. So think healing miracles. Jesus was restoring creation. The second reason he used miracles was to reveal himself. Did you notice those both started with R? Restoration and revelation. I'm getting to be a pastor, right? So he used miracles to reveal himself to people who could recognize him. There's another R, recognize. So those two things. So we need to look at this miracle as either a restoration or a revelation. And if it's a revelation, then it moves a little bit out of that miracle category, although it maintains its miraculous character, and it moves into a sign, the sign of who Jesus is. And I've talked a little bit about that before when I was talking about the blind man who was healed, how Jesus redefined his healing as a sign of who he was, of who Jesus was. And here we get in this story the same thing happening. This is a sign of who Jesus is. So we're going to look at the rest of the story now as a sign, not just a miracle. So the Gospels are written from the perspective of the people who walked and talked with Jesus. And there's a word for that, or a name for that. It's called authoritative insider interpretation. I might have mentioned that here before. This is a really important concept for us when we're studying the Bible, and especially when reading the Gospels and Paul. Authoritative insider interpretation. Someone who is inside of what's happening, so they have the authority to interpret that for us. Here's an example. Okay, so in Jesus' crucifixion, a reporter could have been there, and that person could have reported to us the facts. How much, how many, like how many nails were used, where they were placed, how many people were in the crowd, what the crowd felt, all those facts. And that would be like reporting. Okay? The interpretation, though, of that, of Christ's crucifixion, comes to us from Paul, who said, Christ died for our sins. So that's the authoritative insider interpretation. And it's important for us to remember that the Gospels are authoritative insider interpretation. So when a Gospel writer says, this happened, and this is why, then that's what that is. That's the interpretation that we should be going with. So we have three different types of interpretation because we have three different gospel writers here. Matthew gives us an emphasis on the faith aspect of the walking on water. And Mark gives it to us in light of the feeding of the 5,000. So in all of the gospels, the feeding of the 5,000 comes directly before this happening. And since the gospel writers did not necessarily write their accounts in chronological order, the fact that this always comes after the feeding of the 5,000 hooks those two events together. And there's a few other things that hook them together too that we'll talk about. So Mark gives us that in light of that feeding. John gives us the lens of Old Testament prophecy. So John is big on signs. And he interprets Jesus' miracles as signs, and he brings in Old Testament prophecy. So we see that in John's account where it says the crowd says, truly, this is the prophet that Moses spoke to us about. So they're looking at Jesus saying, this is the prophet. So John's emphasis is not on the storm. It's not on the what can Jesus do for me in the storm. But the emphasis of John is on who Jesus is, and who he is enough. Another thing to look at when we're thinking about this story is the disciples' view of the sea and what happens on the sea. And this is really interesting because it is rooted in their ancient past. The first event with the sea that they would be cognizant of was the creation account. So take a look at your paper. Genesis 1, verses 2 and verses 9. Now the earth was formless and void. The Hebrews translate that the earth was a chaotic waste, with the emphasis on the chaos. The earth was chaos. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths. So get that picture. There's just water, chaotic water covering everything. And then God said, let the water under the sky be gathered into one place and let the dry land appear. And it was so. So we have this picture of just a watery expanse, just a waste, a chaotic wasteland. And God wades in and he starts separating things out. And he says, you go over here. You go over there. You stay right there. And this is the first thing God does is he separates and he shows power over the waters. In Job, this is the Hebrew interpretation of what God did at creation. In Job, it reads, who shut the sea with doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I fixed my limits for it and set bars and doors, when I said, this far you may come, but no farther. Here your proud waves must stop. This is the picture that the Hebrews brought with them, their picture of their God and what he can do with the waters. Okay, so he has separated them and he has controlled the waters. So this is rooted in their ancient past, the great act of creation. And they also have another idea about God and his mastery over the seas that comes from the Exodus, from their deliverance from Egypt. And in the Exodus, there's two things that were really super important that they carried with them through all the time when the nation first started, which was like right at the Red Sea when the nation first started, and they kept that idea with them through the Babylonian captivity and then through the recolonization of the land all the way up to through the Roman occupation of their land. And that is the idea, the importance of God opening the Red Sea and allowing them to walk across. So there they were, if you remember the story, with their backs to the sea and the Egyptian army coming at them from the other side to take them back to Egypt. This is what happens. God comes in a cloud and separates the Egyptian army from the Israelites. The cloud made it dark on one side, but it gave them light through the night on the other side. And Moses held up his staff. God has said to them, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more again forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the water was divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So this is the picture that they have in their DNA, practically, of what their God can do to the waters. So on this one side of them, they have the chaos of the water. On the other side, they have the chaos of the Egyptian army coming after them. And God takes control of the chaos of the Red Sea and does this miracle for them. They also had, in their history, input from other cultures that they'd picked up throughout the years. And one of those is that the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River and the headwaters of the Jordan were tied somehow to the underworld. The Greeks, the pagan Greeks, believed that up at the headwaters of the Jordan was the entrance to hell, and they actually had a name for it. It was called the Gate of Hell. So if you have been to the Holy Land and you've gone to Caesarea Philippi, and then you've gone a little bit farther, and there's the caves and the shrines of Banias, or to the god, what we say, Pan, to the god Pan, right? This was a place where horrible things happened, and no self-respecting Jew would even set foot in the area because they would become immediately unclean just being in the vicinity. They were disgusted with it, and it was called the Gate of Hell, or the Gateway to Hell. Incidentally, this is where Jesus was with his disciples when he asked Peter, "Who do people say that I am?" This is a side note. "Who do people say that I am?" And Peter said, you know, and then Jesus said, "Well, who do you say I am?" And he said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." The gates of hell that we are standing here looking at. Okay? So they also, the pagans also believed that the water from the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River flows from the Gate of Hell, flows down to the Sea of Galilee, and they believed that the waters covered what they called the abyss. And the abyss was the abode of the demons from the underworld, and the dead, who weren't going anywhere else, went to the abyss. And so the Sea of Galilee, the waters of the Sea of Galilee covered that. So you get that cycle, the gates of hell, the water flowing out into the Sea of Galilee, going down into the abyss and then cycling back. And so this was also in the mind of the Jewish people who lived in the area at this time. Whether or not they like embraced it as an actual belief didn't necessarily matter. Okay, so I want to try here an exercise in putting ourselves in the shoes of the disciples as they're out in the boat. Okay, so I want you to picture yourself on Halloween night walking through a graveyard. The wind is blowing. The trees are silhouetted against a full moon and they're swishing back and forth. And all of a sudden an owl hoots. Okay, and so now you're walking through this graveyard. The mist is swirling around, and all of a sudden, this newly made grave that you're coming up on, all of a sudden the ground starts to shift, and an arm punches through, and another arm punches through, and somebody sits up. Okay? So you're sitting here in this church building, and you're going, yes, this certainly would not happen, and da da da. But if you're there, what's your first reaction? Okay? You're gonna be terrified. So this is the same thing that happened to the disciples out on the water. They're floating in a storm over what they have heard is this abyss, the abode of the dead, and all of a sudden, here comes something that looks like a human being. They thought it was a ghost. They thought it was this abyss giving up its dead. Okay, so their first primitive reaction is going to be that terror, which is why Jesus immediately says, "Don't be afraid." Do you hear echoes of that "don't be afraid" in the Red Sea story that we read? Jesus says, "Don't be afraid, be still." Okay, so here is what the terror of the Red Sea is. It represented chaos to them. It was over the abyss, the abode of demons and the dead, and the storm that was happening. They believed, not the disciples specifically, but the Greek pagans believed that when the sea was stormy, it was because the pagan gods were fighting with each other. Okay, and so here comes Jesus. And he says to them, "Take courage, don't be afraid." So if they miss the connection with the Red Sea experience, Jesus gives them another clue as to what he's trying to do here with them. He says to them, "I am." Okay, now if you look in your translations of your Bible, all three of the Gospels will be translated, "It is I." Okay, so that "I" is The phrasing of that, you'll see that it's in italics in some of your translations, which means that the translators added that to try to make the meaning more clear. Okay? But when we see the word, the words ago, I me, which is I am, when we see those without an object, and especially in the Gospel of John, we should be saying, I am. It's awkward because we don't just come up to people and say, hi, I am, and shake their hand, right? We don't do that. It doesn't translate well into our language. But this I am is echoes of what God said to Moses at the burning bush before the Exodus happened. God identifies himself to Moses as I am, and he says, tell the people that I am has sent you. Okay, so this I am has long been, in Hebrew thought, the introduction to God. This is who God is. God is the I am. So when Jesus comes, he's not just saying to them, oh, it's me, Jesus, it's all right, I'm not a ghost, you don't have to be scared. He's saying something different. He's saying, don't be afraid, I am. When he is walking on the water, he says to them, don't be afraid, I am the one who told the waves where to stop. I am the one who made a pathway through the seas. I am the one who, as it says in Job 9:8, who treads on the waters of the sea. I'm not just a miracle worker. I am. So John's readers would have understood this interpretation. They would have understood that Jesus was claiming to be more than just a human agent of God. As you take a look at your handout again. In Exodus, the people of Israel, when they were rescued from the Red Sea and they crossed it and then started on their journey, they knew that it wasn't Moses who saved them. They knew that it was God. So they wrote this song, like you always do when you get out of trouble. You write this song. So here's part of their song. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. Your right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Your right hand, O Lord, has dashed the enemy in pieces. They're not confused. They know that it was not Moses that did this. They knew that it was God that did this. With the blast of your nostrils, the waters were gathered together. The flood stood upright like a heap. The depths became firm in the heart of the sea. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. All the glory was going to God. So when Jesus now is walking on the water, he is not saying, like Moses told the people, I am has done this. What Jesus is saying is, don't be afraid, I am. He's saying, I am the I am. So this is his insider interpretation. We are to understand that Jesus walking on the water means that God is in our midst. I want you to look at Psalm 107, the very last one that I wrote here for you, because the last part of it is important to tie this all together. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's a really good poem. And if any of you guys are fishermen, is anybody in this room actually a fisherman? Okay. So this part of this psalm is like an ode to a fisherman. So those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commands and raises the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves of the sea. They mount up to the heavens. They go down again to the depths. Their soul melts because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man. They are at their wit's end. Then they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distresses. He calms the storm so that its waves are still. Then they are glad because they are quiet, and he guides them to their desired haven. So do you see I can't go through a teaching session without looking at the form, the chiastic form that pops up every now and then. So you see that this part of the psalm is wrapped up with that chiasm, with the center of he calms the storm, its waves are still. Okay, so once again, Jesus, when he calmed this storm, he's harking back to lots of different prophecies. I happen to choose this one out of Psalms because I like the poetry of it. But the disciples are going to be remembering these things. They're going to be remembering the prophecies of the walking on the water, the calming of the storm, and especially the Red Sea, and even all the way back to creation. This is John's interpretation, and this is what John would like us to see in this story. So the disciples are courageous. And so as the church takes this as a comfort story for so many years, we should not stop with just the idea that God can calm our storm. This is the idea of what can Jesus do for me? What can God give to me if I have enough faith? So we need to take that one step farther. We are courageous, not because God can calm our storm, but because God is. There are people in this room probably who God is not going to calm their storm, and they know it. There's people who know that their storm is going to get worse before it gets better. Do we say then, oh, we don't have enough faith, and so if we just had more faith, God would calm my storm? That's not the point of the story. The point is we don't have to be afraid. Be courageous because God is. There he is. So that brings up a question about Peter's faith. Matthew tells us that Jesus said to Peter, oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Okay, well, I just want to say, you know what Peter did? Peter stepped out of that boat. Have you ever thought what was going through Peter's mind and the faith that it took to step out of that boat? So, thank you. So Peter steps out of the boat, and Jesus says to him, you don't have enough faith. What in the world is up with that? So here's the thing about Peter's faith. Okay? Peter's faith is little because Peter's little. Our faith is little because we're little. Are we ever going to have enough faith? We're not. To do these things, we're not going to have enough faith. We're not going to be able to psych ourselves up to do these things. Jesus' power did not get any less because Peter's faith was little. Jesus still had the same power. I hope you've heard this. I'll say it again anyway. It's not how much faith we have. It's who we have our faith in. If we have our faith in Jesus, all of his power is at our disposal, regardless of the size or the weight or the mass of our faith. It's who we have our faith in. So it's not that whether Peter believed that Jesus could keep him on top of the water. It's not whether Peter believed that Jesus was going to calm the storm. It's whether Peter can believe that Jesus is the I Am. So this is the revelation that Jesus walking on water gave to the disciples, and they were astounded by it, as we should be. We should be astounded when we see that Jesus is claiming here to be the I Am. And Mark tells us it's because they didn't understand about the loaves. Okay, remember the feeding of the 5,000 and how it's tied together? They didn't understand about the loaves, and so Jesus walked on water. And that cleared up their misunderstanding. Okay? So what didn't they understand about the loaves? For the answer to this and other exciting questions, come back next month. Let's have a word of prayer. Dear Father, thank you for this story, and thank you for being the one who controls the waves. And please let us realize that because you are I Am, that is enough for us in the storms of life. In your name, amen.